You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson. Coming up, the election dominated the news in 2016, but there were a lot of other news items in Wisconsin as well. We'll look back at some of the top stories with Rob Menser. First, Chinese food is one of the oldest culinary traditions in human history. But when many people think of Chinese food, they often think of only a small section of it. Cantonese food, Sichuan cooking, or maybe Beijing dumplings. But China has 34 provinces and regions, and each of these has a unique geography, climate, and ethnic background. All of these elements contribute to the rich cuisine and to China's deep and diverse food history. Today, we're learning about the different kinds of cooking that China has to offer. Keelum Chan joins us now via Skype very early in the morning for him from Hong Kong. He's the co-author of the giant book, China, the Cookbook. His father was the editor-in-chief and food critic for a prominent Hong Kong newspaper. Keelum, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon.
It's great to have you with us. And again, thank you for getting up so early. So how important would you say that food is to Chinese culture?
It probably ranks number one in terms of importance. I'm getting some echoes for some reason. Anyway, it is very important to us, and often we greet each other. So that is foremost in our minds, food.
We're having a little hard time hearing you. So you said it's very important to Chinese culture. Is it also very important to Chinese social gatherings?
Oh, yes, because Chinese food is very much for sharing. Okay, it is a chance for the family to get together with friends to celebrate or something like that. So food is important because it is something that we share together, and that gives us a great chance to communicate, to share ideas and share feelings and so on. So food is more than just something to put in the stomach. It is something for us to give us a chance to socialize. And so yes, food is important.
And you share in the book that one of your first cooking lessons was from your father, and it revolved around roasting a duck. What happened with that?
Well, he was having a banquet at home, and of course, while he prepares many dishes, he gave me the chore of doing a roast duck, and I had seen him done it beforehand. So I said, no problem. You know, I lit a charcoal stove and put the duck on the fork and start roasting it. Well, the way I see it is that when the color of the duck is nice golden brown, the duck is done. So I sort of know. Sat on a little stool and with a fork in hand with a big duck at the end of it and roasted for, I would say, somewhere around, you know, maybe half an hour. And the color was great, beautiful, nice brown color. And I said, great, now duck's done. It also smelled very good. Well, anyway, but when it comes time to serve the duck and chopping it open, well, it wasn't quite done in the center. So
I'm guessing it was quite raw in the center, actually.
Yeah, so anyway, so the duck was not served because it was just could not be eaten. But fortunately, I was not scolded by my father. He knew that I had not done it before. But he told me, he said, look, you know, if you want to cook, cook with your heart, not just with your hands. But that he means that you have to think about what you do, okay? Beforehand, before you start doing it, think about, you know, for example, what is a cooked duck? How should it be done and so on? So this is something that stayed with me. I would say it was my first lesson in cooking, and it's something that has stayed with me for the last many, many years. And this is something I put in all my books, Cook with Your Heart.
Now, you and your wife did this cookbook together. Mm-hmm. How did you choose the recipes that are in it? Because there are so many to choose from.
That was quite a difficult thing to do. We struggled quite a bit. We set a certain criteria. Certainly, number one is that the ingredients must be available or a substitute can be found, okay, because it's no good to have a recipe when you cannot get ingredients. And secondly is that the outcome, when the dish is done, it's got to be something I think that would be acceptable to people outside of China. Okay, not something strange and so on. So something that I would say a normal family would will look at it and say, aha, this is something very tasty and very good. So it's got to be acceptable. And thirdly, the balance is important because we have so many regions and sub-regions. We want to make sure that each of the regions is represented to some degree, okay, some more or some less, but they should be there. Okay, because China is such a big country, and we want people to know about the diversity and the various things they can do. So balance is important for us to make sure that all the regions are represented. And then the other thing we need to think about was the ingredients. For example, I cannot have a book half of which are fish. Okay, so it's got to be a balance between fish and various types of meat and vegetable and so on. And then, of course, lastly, the style of cooking. We have soup, we have desserts, we have, you know, whatever. Okay, so it's got to be quite well represented in total and in good balance. And we spent quite a bit of time struggling over how to select and which one to select from. But ultimately, when the book was done, I think we were quite pleased with the result.
And you're talking about how you chose the recipes and finding that balance, but that's exactly what you recommend for people to do when they're planning a meal that they're going to cook for family or friends, to finding that balance. And that includes also things like cool dishes and hot dishes and crispy dishes and soft dishes. Why is that balance so important in Chinese cuisine?
Well, I think it's a balance of flavor. For example, we want to make sure that when we have a meal, we have it's not all the same taste. We want to know. Let's say, for example, we can have sweet and sour. We can have salty food and so on. And because eating is a form of enjoyment, okay. And we want to experience various kinds of flavors and colors and so on when we eat. So it is important for us to plan our meal ahead of time. And secondly is that, it is actually quite a bit of work to put out a meal for many people, whether it's in Chinese, American, or otherwise. And I think it is important to plan ahead of time. And usually in the kitchen, when you do too many things similar, then you have trouble because time is limited and you want to share with your friends. So plan ahead of time. We can do some cold dishes at half time, maybe some deep frying and then with a quick frying to follow and so on. Because you plan based on what you have at home equipment-wise and based on the techniques you use so that when it comes time to serve dinner, you are well planned and things will follow very, very smoothly rather than having all the dishes bunched up together and then you don't know which one to serve first. So that is important, planning, having the right balance, having the right kind of taste, and also having the right kind of a sequence. It is important for us to have things like the heavier taste food will come later, with a lighter, more bland food comes first, because your palate will not be destroyed. For example, if you start with a very hot dish and then you follow by something less so, and then your palate will not be able to differentiate the different kind of flavors. So I think that is important.
We're talking with Keelum Chan right now. His book is China, the Cookbook, and it is a massive undertaking and clearly one that was undertaken with love. His father was the editor-in-chief and food critic for a prominent Hong Kong newspaper, and that's in large part where he got his love of cooking. And Keelum, so let's dig into some of these specifics, because I'm already hungry and I want to talk about some of these recipes. So one of the areas that you talk about is Guangdong. And what are some of the examples of the cuisine from Guangdong?
Well, probably the most famous dish from Guangdong that I think most Americans would know is sweet and sour spare rib or sweet and sour pork. This is also a favorite in China as well. So I would say if we talk about Canton Guangdong food, you cannot get away from sweet and sour spare rib. Some people say this is American invention. Well, it is not so. It is really, truly a Chinese dish. Probably introduced some about 200 years ago, I would say, because a lot of foreigners came to China at around that time. And so sweet and sour, I think, sweet and sour spare was created about that time because, again, I think the flavor was probably more acceptable to people new to China, a nice blend with sweet and sour. And that sweet and sour pork was introduced into America, I think, in the late I would say, late 19th century, when a lot of Chinese workers went to America to work on the railroads mm-hmm. or whatever. And then when they opened restaurants, that was probably the first dish they did and were accepted by the Americans.
And what are some of the main flavors in that dish? What are some of the main flavors in those sweet and sour spare ribs?
Well, actually, I would say, of course, you have to. We use vinegar and sugar. Those are the two prime ingredients. But other than that, we use spare ribs. We have bell peppers. We have pineapple. And that's pretty much it. It's a very easy dish to do. You deep fry the spare ribs first, and then you stir fry with the vegetable and the sauce. And it really does only takes a few minutes to do.
And we've posted a link to Keelum's recipe for sweet and sour spare ribs on the Central Time page of the WPR website, and it's also linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And now another one that sounds really good to me, and this one comes from Hong Kong, the recipe for shrimp with vermicelli. And what is it about that dish that you enjoy?
Okay. This is actually one of our creation at home. Hong Kong, as you may well know, is quite international, not exactly from all the foreign countries, but also we take a lot of ideas from China mainland as well. This is really created based on a Sichuanese style of cooking shrimps. Okay, a little bit hot, spicy, and then we added vermicelli to it to absorb the sauces that comes on from cooking the shrimps. So this, I would say, this is a home creation, and all of our guests love it. And then usually when it's done and if they're leftovers, they would say, can I have a doggy bag to bring them home?
So, and is there much of a sauce with that, or is it more of a dry dish?
Well, it's sort of dry because the vermicelli absorb most mm-hmm. of the sauces. But it is not totally dry. You have some sauce, so it's a little bit wet. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's not dry like maybe chow mein or mm-hmm. something like that, but it's not saucy as well because you don't have a lot of sauce floating around on surrounding the vermicelli. So I would say it's a moist dish. Okay, people would carry it. In fact, the flavor went all the flavor went into the vermicelli because they absorb all the flavors, and this is the part that people enjoy most.
Well, and I want to say that you make a note that Americans in general like their shrimp peeled and everything taken off it, but you say that Chinese people tend to leave the shells and the heads on for flavor, and I want to agree with you. That adds so much flavor.
Yeah, that is true, because people don't know that shells and heads have a lot of flavor itself. Sometimes, you know, we do peel our shrimp sometimes, and when I do that, I would save the head and the shell. I would put it in a little water and cook it for about half an hour, and then extract the broth from it. So that's like a shrimp broth. I would save it, and then next time when I do something like noodles, I would use that broth and make it into a shrimp noodle. Very, very tasty.
I agree with you. We're talking to Keelum Chan right now about all of the different kinds of Chinese cuisine. He has put them all together in a beautiful book. It's called China, the Cookbook. And we're taking your calls now, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Chinese cooking or Chinese baking? What Chinese or Chinese-inspired dishes do you like to cook at home or would like to? You can call now at 800-642-1234 or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up our discussion now about Chinese cooking with Keelum Chan. He and his wife wrote a gigantic cookbook over 700 pages, and it's chock full of wonderful Chinese recipes. The book is called China, the Cookbook. And we're taking your calls now, too, at 800-642-1234. What kind of Chinese cooking do you do at home? What are some of your favorite ingredients that you use in Chinese cuisine? And what questions do you have for Keelum about Chinese cooking? Call in and share your recipes or with your questions now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, Keelum, over and over in your book, I read about how important fresh ingredients are. And when you say fresh, I think it's a pretty high level. How fresh do you mean?
Well, when it comes to vegetables, we would buy vegetables that are picked in the morning, okay, same day. We don't buy day-old vegetables. Okay, and when we buy fish, it should be something that is swimming in the tank, not something on a sheet of ice. That's the preferred fish, of course. And then when it comes to meat, it's got to be something that is slaughtered on the same day. So typically, the slaughterhouses will do the animals early in the morning, and by the time market opens up, we get fresh meat. So this is how fresh we would like it to be.
And you made a point of saying that, you know, that might not be possible for a lot of people shopping in the U.S., especially with the meat. Yeah. But that there are small things you can do, like instead of buying cut up chicken to cook, at least buy a whole chicken because it's probably a little fresher overall.
I think that is true. And not only is it fresher, it actually tastes better. We believe meat with bones on it has a much better flavor. So we would always like to have our chicken whole. Similarly to fish, we would eat the fish. We would take a whole fish. If we want fillet, we would do the fillet ourselves or ask the fishmonger to do the filleting. But that would guarantee some freshness rather than something prepackaged and one has absolutely no idea how long it has been. So this is, I would say, something that I would advise. Yeah, people who cannot get the swimming fish or something like that, try to get the whole piece and then do the cutting up yourself. I think that would be a little bit fresher.
Let's go to our listeners now. Larry in Reidsville is on the line. Hi, Larry.
Hello.
Hi, Larry.
This probably pertains to what you just said about serving the whole fish, but I've noticed for birds, animals of all sorts, when served in China, they include the head and the feet in the dish. And I was wondering, is there any symbolism behind including the head and the whole body when they serve an entree?
Thanks for the call.
Well, it depends. Probably not. But on the other hand, for example, if you take a chicken, okay, we usually serve the chicken with the head and the tail. And in a sense, it is for completeness. Because when we cook the chicken, we cook the chicken whole. And oftentimes the chicken is used in offerings. You know? Sometimes, you know, so certain people, and it's an ancient old tradition, they would make offerings to the ancestors or to the gods and to Buddha or whatever. And when they do that, they offer the whole chicken rather than cut up pieces. And so this is how we serve something like this, a chicken or a fish, because of its wholeness, its completeness. Rather than cut up, this is pretty much what we do with smaller pieces of animals, like fish and chicken. Of course, we can't do with the pig and head and beef and all that, and that's for practical reasons. But I would say, yes, it sort of symbolizes completeness, if I can say that. Of course, besides that, I think oftentimes the fish head tastes very good. I like it myself. So when we serve a fish, head and tails are really the choiciest part of the fish, and people would buy for it, and people would say, mm-hmm. Who gets the fish, who gets the head, and who gets the tail? But that's just on the practical side of something that we like to eat. But symbolizes-wise, symbolic-wise, it is, I think, for completeness more than anything else.
Thanks for that call, Larry. And Keelum, I wanted to ask you, there were periods in China's history where food was scarce. And I'm guessing that must have had an impact on how the cuisine developed. Do you see signs of that?
Yes, I think so. This is something that evolved through history. You know, we've had all kinds of events like wars, famines, and natural disasters and so on. So when people cook, they try to use every part, all of the ingredients. Nothing goes to waste. They will always think of ways to make use of all the parts, whether it's meat or vegetable and so on. And even the poorest people, you know, with whatever stuff they can get, would come up with ingenious ways of making use of it. So nothing ever goes to waste, and that reflects, you know, in a sense, it's a result of our history. It is something that evolves through history, and people learn to make use of everything. Nothing goes to waste.
Russ in Monroe is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Russ.
a big fan of NPR, especially Food Friday. I like to cook, and if I wanted to cook some items out of your guest book, is there something, are there items you could recommend for my pantry that would kind of get me ready to do various dishes beyond soy sauce, obviously, sure. and oyster sauce?
Great. Thanks, Russ. So, Keelum, what are some of the things that we should always have in our pantry to be able to make good Chinese food?
I think Russ already mentioned that, you know, soy sauce, oyster sauce, and I think with a little vinegar, of course, it is and it's important to us. I think those are just the basic ingredients. With that, you can do most kinds of Chinese food, except for some specialty foods where we say, I need a special kind of paste and sauce. Sesame oil is important. I add a certain flavor to it. It's very, very nice. Aside from that, you don't really need much. No, so I would say most homes can do Chinese cooking anytime, because if you already have a bottle of soy sauce at home, oyster sauce, if you have it, that's fine. If you don't have it, that is also okay. I would say soy sauce, vinegar, sesame oil are the three basic things you should have at home, and everything else is just extras.
And Keelum, I want to make sure, because I know that a lot of people are listening and I think are going to be interested in checking out your wonderful book. Let's talk briefly as we wrap up here about serving sizes, because you say that traditionally in China, you cook one dish for each person that's there and then everyone shares everything. So when there's a serving size in your cookbook, what does that mean exactly?
Well, when we cook a dish, for example, a dish, if you share it with, I'm going to say, let's say, dish is for four people. That means four people can share into the dish, and in each person we get a pretty ample portion. Of course, a dish that says four person can also be served to eight people, but then that means that you have another dish that also has, you know, can be shared. So I would say serving is sort of like a guide. We never really cook for one.
And we'll have to leave it there. Keelum, thank you so much for joining us today. It was great, and for getting up early to join us. That was Keelum Chan, co-author of China, the Cookbook. He joined us via Skype live from Hong Kong early in the morning.